Hello, this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin. My guest today is Dr. Amir Khan, a full-time GP. He regularly appears on television shows such as GPs Behind Closed Doors, How to Lose a Stone for the Summer, and Why I Can't Sleep. More recently, he's also made countless appearances on news outlets, providing medical insights throughout the pandemic. His book, The Doctor Will See You Now, charts the highs and lows of life as an NHS GP. Dr. Khan, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Hi, Georgina. Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a fascinating book because it's also about your life and the human connections. And you speak about the impact that your GP, Dr. George, had on your family growing up. How important was he as a role model for you in your career?
Dr. George was like a really big part of our family life, really, because my mum holds doctors in really high regard. She's, you know, we're from a working class family. My mum worked her way up from a cleaner to a social worker. My dad was a bus driver. And so doctors were really revered. And Dr. George, she was a lady, actually, it was Fiona George. And she was just like the pinnacle of everything my mum thought doctors should be. She knew us really well. She knew us individually. She asked about us when we went to see her. She'd ask about other family members. And it was that really kind of old-fashioned family doctor that we all kind of dream of having, which is really hard to kind of get now. But back then, it was really important. And I remember really clearly when Dr. George retired, and she had a bit of a tea party in the waiting room, which again, we'd never do that now, you know, for kind of infection control purposes. Mm. But she had a tea party in the waiting room for all her patients, and my mum wore her wedding sari to it. It was such a big deal, and I remember her getting dressed up and putting on her earrings, and she was really sad but really excited to be invited to this, and it was that kind of moment that I thought, wow, you know, doctors can have a real impact on people's lives, and particularly GPs, and we don't often hear about that side from general practice. You know, a lot of the drama we imagine happens in hospital, and a lot of the impact we imagine happens in hospital, but so much can happen in general practice and in the community.
Absolutely. It's a completely integral part of our day-to-day life, isn't it? My mother was a doctor, and she was talking about how things had changed. She was a doctor for 50 years, and she said one thing she really noticed now was that people never touched you. She said her main job as a GP was to lay her hands on people and for people to feel that contact. And she felt when she was a patient in her later years, that just never really happened.
No. And I train GPs as well, actually. I've been a GP now for over 10 years. I've been a doctor for 16 years, I think, now. And, you know, you have to gauge the situation. It's not that we don't touch people completely. You know, if there's an elderly lady or an elderly person, you know, or, a child, a gentle hand on their hand is always, you know, appropriate if needed. We've got to be very careful, of course, and I would give that advice to my GP trainees. But you're absolutely right. Things have changed, and there's a lot of pressure on GPs now, not just, you know, through the volume of demand, but also the box ticking exercises. And you know, when it's just the doctor and the patient, when it's just me and my patient in the room, you know, that core part of general practice hasn't changed in all the years that it's been around, but it's everything else around that puts pressure on that situation and can take away from those nuances that are so important.
Mm. Now, your book, The Doctor Will See You Now, follows your 15 years working as a GP, from rookie to becoming a partner in one of the UK's busiest surgeries. Tell me about the surgery and your working pattern there. I mean, presumably the numbers are pretty overwhelming.
Yes, so it is a busy surgery. It's in inner city Bradford, and we have a very kind of multicultural patient base, which is brilliant. It's why I want to work there. We have 25,000 patients registered at our practice. It's incredibly busy. You know, the doors open at 8 o'clock, but before then, there's always a big queue of patients. There's a big rush on the phones when the phone lines open, and within minutes, your clinic lists will be full, and then extras will be added on because patients need to be seen. And so from the moment you get in, and it doesn't matter how early you get in, I'm an early bird and I get in very early at about 7, quarter past 7. From the minute you get in, you are working flat out right through to the end of the day. But, you know, and I say all of this in my book, the kind of things that really help you know, keep you going amongst all that pressure is your colleagues. My colleagues are just amazing. I work with some of the best GPs, and I learn from them every day. The best nurses, again, I learn from them as well. And it makes a big difference. And we're friends outside of work. And I think that's really helped me, because you hear so much about GPs burning out, healthcare professionals burning out. And I think that would be a real risk if I didn't have the support of my colleagues and the friendships of my colleagues. And so, yeah, that makes a big difference for me.
And of course, on top of all of that work, you've now got this huge media career and you make television programmes. Why?
That's a good question. It happened completely by accident. The Channel 5 show GPs Behind Closed Doors were looking for a surgery in the north. It's quite interesting because they've only ever filmed in London, and they did one series in Bristol, and they kind of lumped the whole of the north of England as the north. So they'd come to us, and they'd been to Manchester and Liverpool and Newcastle, and we were the last practice that they'd come up to, and they were like, oh, we're just searching the north of England for a big, you know, practice and all of this kind of stuff. And I think we tempted them with lemon cake. Debbie, one of our nurse practitioners, made a beautiful lemon cake, and I think that got us the show. it was brilliant. And then, you know, I was very lucky. I had some really interesting patients, really interesting stories on the show, and that people responded really well to you know, the way I interacted. But again, it was all down to the patient stories rather than me. And so from there, I just kind of went and did other things. But what's quite nice is I can balance it out with my NHS work. I'm still very much an NHS GP, and all of this I do in my annual leave or my spare time and that kind of thing. I haven't had a holiday for a while because I'm spending all my annual leave doing this kind of thing. So yeah, hopefully next year I'll get a holiday.
But some of those subjects that you cover on television, I mean, for instance, why we can't sleep, but also how to lose a stone for summer, for instance, all of that's so interesting. Are there quick fixes?
Well, there are some simple things you can do to help you sleep, for example. So just getting the temperature right in your room is really important. Making sure it's not too hot. Like I said, we've had some hot days, but 18 degrees is about the right temperature. Making sure your daily life isn't too stressful. Making sure you take regular breaks. You know, not having caffeine after 6 p.m. Simple things are quite good in terms of helping you sleep. Losing weight is different. You know, there are no quick fixes to that. It's all about a healthy, balanced lifestyle if you want to maintain it. And even though the show talks about fad diets, it's very clear that these are not long-term solutions. So that was really important for me to get that message across. And I'm constantly talking about sleep, healthy lifestyles, weight loss with my patients. So they often go hand in hand with what I'm doing at work.
Mm. I mean, the government has been talking about chronic pain now being managed not through analgesics, but through exercise. Is that realistic?
Well, this is something GPs have been aware of for a long, long time. You know, we know there's a massive problem with painkiller addiction, particularly around the opiate-based painkillers. So we're talking about codeine, tramadol, morphine, all these things, you know, particularly after 3 months. You know, if you've been on it for longer than that, the chances are they're not effective pain relief, but you can be addicted to them and you can become tolerant to them. Hence, you need larger doses to achieve the same effect. And it's not necessarily that your pain is getting worse, it's just that the effects of the tablets have worn off. And we know that long-term pain and long-term painkiller addiction can lead to depression and anxiety and all of these things that go hand in hand with pain. It is so difficult to get people to accept that, because, and I would be feeling exactly the same, you know, if I was in long-term pain and every single movement hurt, and my doctor said to me, actually, this thing that I've been prescribing for you has actually done you more harm than good, that's a really difficult message to get across. And you can understand why patients would be anxious and angry with you. And I've had lots of those difficult conversations. And the key is really to get them on board with the understanding, with the evidence, slowly reduce the pain relief. Nobody should suddenly stop it, and gently introduce these exercises. It doesn't apply to everyone. Not everyone in chronic pain can do exercise, but there will be some people who it will apply to. And it's not just exercise, it's psychological therapies as well, because long-term pain will play havoc with your mental health. So people need support for that as well.
Mm. Now, of course, we are living in extraordinary times at the moment. And I wonder how unique it's been working throughout the pandemic. I mean, it's something that you can't really prepare for. How did it change your role as a GP?
Yeah, it changed it really dramatically. You know, as a junior doctor, I had kind of role played things like bomb scares and terrorist attacks and even a flu pandemic, but nothing quite like this. You know, this isn't anything like the models of the flu pandemics that we rehearsed for. Immediately, you know, all the face-to-face contact that we had ceased and we had to go remote. So we did telephone calls and video calls. We did still see patients who needed to be seen. That's really important, that patients that needed to be seen had to be seen. But then we split our sites into what we call red hubs and blue hubs. So in the blue hubs, we'd see patients who didn't have symptoms of coronavirus, who definitely didn't have a temperature or a cough. And they may come in with things like abdominal pains or headaches and that kind of thing. But then we were routed into these red hubs where patients who weren't unwell enough to go to hospital, but were unwell enough to need to be assessed by a doctor to see whether they could be managed at home, and they had a temperature and a cough. And this was at the height of, you know, the lockdown and the pandemic, and stories of clinicians dying, seeing patients were really, you know, coming to the forefront at that point. And specifically, and I'll be honest, you know, people from BAME communities were dying in higher numbers, both, you know, members of the public and clinicians. And so when I got my first email about my shift at the Red Hub, there was no doubt I was going to go, I'm lucky enough not to suffer from mental health problems. I had terrible anxiety. I had anxiety the night before, you know, and I was a bit, I'll be honest, I was ashamed of the way I was feeling. I was scared because, you know, there were so many kind of messages coming out about NHS heroes and rainbows in people's windows and how we were angels and warriors. So the fact that I was scared about going to see these patients and getting the virus and perhaps bringing it home to my family, I was just really embarrassed about it. And I remember driving to my first shift at the Red Hub and just being so nervous and having to listen to kind of calming music. And once I got in there, you know, when you get into the role and the zone and you start seeing patients, it's not hugely different to what I was normally doing. I was just wearing PPE and that kind of thing. But it was really anxiety inducing. And I think it's really important that that gets addressed, because all these ideas of doctors just going into work selflessly, I mean, there will certainly be doctors and nurses who did all of that, but I think there is a cohort of people who will have suffered mental health problems as a result. Mm. You know, doctors will have seen people, you know, dying in higher numbers than they've ever done before. And then, you know, I was also going into nursing homes as well, where this virus was ravaging through the patients that I had known for years and years and years. And that was really, really tough, having conversations with family members, things that I would normally do in person. You know, you talked about putting a hand on someone's hand. I would have done that when I was telling someone's wife that their partner had died from the coronavirus. I was doing it over the phone, and it just felt so alien. It was tough, and it still is tough. But we pulled together and just did our best.
Now, you also present the coronavirus swab test instructions video for the NHS. So how do we do it properly? I mean, I felt like I'd kind of stabbed the bottom of my brain and shoved it sort of right down into my stomach. It was horrible. Made me gag.
Yeah, it is horrible. There's no doubt. Well, it's uncomfortable, let's say. And I had to do it for the video. I've done it, you know, because I actually got the virus very early on in the pandemic, and I had to do it then as well. But the best way to do it, it's fiddly. It's not difficult. It's fiddly. So you get the long stick with the spongy bit on the end, the swab bit on the end, and open your mouth as wide as possible. And really take care not to touch your teeth or tongue, and just swab and move it around the tonsils, the back of your tonsils at the back.
Oh, I'm just gagging at the thought. Sorry.
Oh, no. It's fine. Then you have to take the same swab and do the same up your nose, but not too far up, about 2 centimetres. So rotate it clockwise in one nostril, and then the same on the other nostril. The key is not to touch anything else, because there's so much bacteria everywhere else. So you just want to get the places where the coronavirus is likely to sit. So that's the thing. But you're right. It's uncomfortable. It is uncomfortable, and it's fiddly, but it's not impossible. Bearing in mind, I've had 5 years of medical school training to do it, so it's slightly easier for me.
Absolutely. Listen, your book is wonderful. It's a very powerful story of hope, of love and compassion. It's also a rare insider account of what really goes on behind those surgery doors. And I thank you for sharing all that with us. Dr. Amir Khan, thank you for speaking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you so much.
The Doctor Will See You Now by Dr. Amir Khan is published by Ebury Press. You've been listening to Monocle Reads, thanks to the production team of Nora Hull, Steph Chungu and Charlie Filmer-Court. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.